Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Tim Siebels. Tim Siebels' latest book, Buffalo Head Solos, was published by Cleveland State University Press in 2004. His other books include Hammerlock, published in 1999, and Hurdy-Gurdy, published in 1992, both by Cleveland State, and Body Moves, published by Corona Press in 1988. He is an NEA fellow and has led workshops for Cave Canem, a retreat for African-American writers, and for the Zora Neale Hurston Richard Wright Foundation. He was born in Philadelphia but taught English for 8 years at Inner City North Dallas High School, then at the Episcopal School of Dallas for 2 years. He lives in Norfolk, Virginia, where he is Associate Professor of Creative Writing and teaches in the MFA program there. Hi, Tim. How you doing?
Hey, Jan. I am well.
It's great to have you.
Nice to be back.
Yeah. So you're going to read some poems from your new book?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to start off with the first poem in the book. It's from a series of poems that are all ambition poems, and they're in the voices of different creatures. The first poem is called Cow and Microphone, and it's in the voice of a cow, if a cow might say such things. Cow and Microphone. There's so much I can't make a sound for. Sunrise on a hillside, or a cool dusk bluing a meadow. Late June, or better yet, mid-September, when the first flecks of autumn begin to walk summer down from its tall heat. How can anything living not love the color light spins on October, when the bulls hum the last unnibbled pasture? Wonderful. Sometimes I think I could lend my own true music to that slow farewell, the daylight bleeding, a whole season turning away, switching its tail, and my voice, an encyclopedia of lovely noise, flies open to the first page, and I'm Ella Fitzgerald's raging treble clef. I'm a four-legged flugelhorn, a glad clarinet, the radical ambassador scatting a voluptuous river of sacks, blowing the rest of the lows into a dumb herd while I run the whole range of my Angus heart. Loneliness, the light, always a clear view to death, the prevailing hands of the powerful and sweet, sweet grass, the earth's free bread, grown back, and lately the knowledge that an animal like me can't be heard exactly, and all this breaks out of my teeth into the bovine world, my bruised tongue at last an angel's lash driving the stampede, and shouldn't I be the Pied Piper? My stomachs are full of rare news and the cruel promise of slaughter. Isn't the other language underneath this? Isn't there one word that still brands you? And I'll read a poem called For Handsome George. It has an epigraph from a poem by Rumi, just a little piece of it. Things are reversed. One who should be hung is made emperor. People stand and clap. For Handsome George. When it comes to my country, I'm like a chipmunk snarling at an avalanche, like a dragonfly slamming its sharp beak into the wilding steel of an 18-wheeler. I hate to throw my weight around, bashing trucks, turning back half a mountain of marauding stone. But I've got the good reasons. I got the uncounted votes. I have as many legs as a millipede, which explains the way I waltz. Why some of me can can-can, while the rest of me just bops. It's hard for me not to feel perky with Handsome George in the White House, with the police so ready to serenade my profile, this brown skin, the sexiest rose in America's garden, and speaking internationally, why wonder who mighta coulda? Let's just globalize. Let's just bomb everywhere, just in case some small nation thinks we ain't got the brass papayas. I don't like to exaggerize. I don't mean to seem the way I be, but with this one star-spangled tree dropping fruit all over, with its long shade like a collie's lolly lick on the glad face of the world, I wonder how anybody can keep from crowing. Chim chimney, chim chimney, chim chim tree. I'll read Jimmy's Blues, which is a poem I wrote thinking about the life of Jimi Hendrix and some of the issues that were maybe less apparent in his music. This poem also has an epigraph. It's simply after the Band of Gypsies tour, spring 1970. And most people know Hendrix dies that fall after the Isle of Wight show, about a month after the Isle of Wight concert. Jimmy's Blues. Man, I'm just sending up smoke signals, that's all. 'Cause it's raining everywhere, and it's lonely to be lonely. If I couldn't play guitar, I'd be out there on a megaphone. When you get down to it, ain't no other music but SOS music. And if nobody's listening, might as well get a mirror and play charades. When we first hit the scene, they had us opening for the Monkees. Seriously, a million bubblegum and teeny boppers dying to see Davy Jones. Then here I come, the so-called Black Elvis, black hippie with a white guitar. You should have seen their faces. Talk about lonely. We did this little loose jam at a street party in Harlem. And nobody knew me there neither, since black radio wasn't playing the music, since rock is supposed to be a white thing, since the world's gone skin crazy. But I'm trying to get some other eyes, you know, maybe see a color deeper than pain, bluer than anything you ever knew. People saying, he gotta be high to play like that, but gotta's not a reason. And high don't take me that far from here. And half my dreams, I swear, I'm on this train with all these people trying to sing, but I can't hear my voice. And somebody says, you're bleeding. Then out the window, I see my mother wave. That's why playing solos is like sending up flares. Some nights, I'm not just a message in a bottle. Nights when I've actually said something with my hands. That's when I hope somebody's out there looking for me. But nobody gets found, and nobody ever finds paradise. So people think they gotta die to get to heaven, which is what I want the music to be, you know, a sound that's wide enough to ride somewhere, someplace where the weather is better and you can be with everybody all the time. And the words would be real, not that life wouldn't be mysterious, just not as hard to understand. And maybe I could put my guitar down, maybe get off stage for a little while and think about just talking like a brand new man.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Tim Siebels, reading from his new book, Buffalo Head Solos. I love your poems.
Thank you, Jan.
They're great.
It's a pleasure.
But this book seems different, and We were talking about that just briefly, but it seems like you really get inside of what you're saying in this book. I mean, I've read your other books, which are great, but this one seems to be inside different conversations, like the cultural conversation that needs to happen, the conversation on the street, the conversation in your head, in the head of the of men and women, in the poems, and you know. But it seems like somehow you got inside the world of things, and I wonder if you could talk about if you agree with that and how you did it.
I mean, it's always hard to talk about your own work, you know, because it feels. I mean, even though I can tell I'm a different writer book to book, but it'd be hard to explain exactly how. But I think in part, the older you get and the longer you write, the more you inhabit both language and your own consciousness. And so I think there's a certain kind of convergence of kind of, I mean, intimate understanding, I guess is the best word I can come up with. But so maybe in this book, and I felt something different about this book, to be honest, maybe this book is kind of like just one of those most, it's something that represents the kind of convergence of a certain kind of, I don't know, maturity is always a suspicious word. I'm not sure I'm getting any more mature. But perhaps it just means there's a number of things you've been learning along the way as you wrote, and then maybe one collection or at least hopefully several poems in the collection represent like all those things coming together and harmonizing in a certain kind of way. Also, the truth is that the older you get, the more you get to think about things and look at the world, how it works. And we're in a pretty dire situation right now, given the current political scene. And I don't mean only nationally, but even internationally and on lots of levels. To some extent, we're all products of our times, and the time demands that we take bigger risks or look harder at what we're trying to say. And so this book may be also the result of that, that I felt a level of pressure in my head and in my heart that might be somewhat different than books past. Though truthfully, you know, I can't say exactly, but it feels like something new is happening. And you just hope that it's a good thing and that it makes the poems come more to life or reach more people or embody something that is, you know, more valuable or something. I don't know what else you might say.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of risk, at the beginning of this book, you have an open letter to your readers in which you say what's on your mind. And I'm just going to read a very short moment of sure. This. You say, "This culture, deranged by both spoken and unspoken imperatives, mocks the complexity of our loneliness, our spiritual hunger for dynamic meanings, our thirst for genuine human community, for good magic and good sense. And given the growing heap of human wreckage, why not approach language and its transforming potential with a ravishing hunger, with a ferocity bordering on the psychotic?" Okay, this, you know, usually isn't done at the beginning of a poetry book, and I want to talk about, I mean, it is a risk, I would think, you know, in terms of selling the book.
Sure.
Getting down to that level. How do you think about the act of doing that, and was it an issue with your editor?
Well, interestingly, Cleveland State University Press, they're very good people, and they have allowed me all kinds of leeway in the way I've approached my poems. And so I give a shout out to Cleveland State. But it just seemed like, again, given the times we live in, I mean, I love poetry, and I love many kinds of poetry, but there's also this kind of, there's a current in American poetry that seems utterly disconnected from the plight that we're living in. Like, it's very smart and very internal, and that's all it's about. Like, aren't you amazed at how clever and smart and well-crafted these are? And ultimately, that is not why I go to art. I don't go to art because I want to be impressed by someone's intelligence. I go to art to be reached, so that someone can help me see things that I am desperate to see. And I think the poetry that I love most is the poetry that wants to talk to somebody. And when I wrote that introduction, what I wanted to do was simply provide a context, not only for my own work, which I guess I certainly does, but also for a set of possibilities for poetry. I don't want poetry to be seen as something for college students or something for people who have lots of degrees. Poetry is for human beings. It is one human a poem is one human being talking to another. It can be complex, it can be simple, it can be whatever. But it's got to be about something real to people. Basically what I'm trying to say in the introduction is I'm tired of messing around. I don't want to keep running to people who say stuff like, "Oh, poetry, whatever." It's like, "Nah." I mean, when people bring up music, no one says, "Oh, music, well, whatever. I don't really listen to music." You know?
Some people do.
Yeah, right. Probably some, but for the most part, people don't feel as comfortable saying, "Oh, music's not part of my life." But people have no problem saying, "Huh, I haven't read poetry in 30 years." And I'm thinking, well, why the hell not? I mean, people who write poems are people who think hard about what it means to be people. And it can be on any level. I mean, it can be as deep or as dark, or it can be funny and crazy and bright in the heart. But, you know, someone's got to talk seriously about what's happening with us here. And given the time we live in, again, this is a weird time. I think we're on the precipice of something perhaps really terrible. Now, that being said, I also think it is possible that if we pay attention, we can turn this to our benefit, because, you know, bad news can also be used as a way of energizing a community and waking people up and saying, hold up. I don't want to die. Let's do it this way. Let's be friendlier. Let's try and rethink this for a minute. So, but I do think the time is to, and this is not the time to be mincing words. And I'm really in that book. I mean, in no book do I try to mince words, but right. In this book, I'm more conscious of the idea that you just have to say the thing that I mean, you want to write well. I'm not just here to just, you know, rant and rave and make a platform of a certain set of ideas. But in the context of hopefully poems that are well considered, you want to say things that feel essential in some way, that feel like people need to hear them, you know, or that it shouldn't be, I don't know, optional. Poetry, optional. We can live without it. I don't think we can. And in the introduction, I say as much, really.
Yeah. Okay. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Tim Siebels, reading from his book, Buffalo Head Solos. So how about more poems?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So I'll read this poem because it's a strange poem, but there was a note given to my girlfriend by her niece, or one of her nieces, and the note was about how much fun she'd had being with her, and she ended the note with, "I hope that we will meet again if we meet again." And I thought, I don't know, man, all the things just went off in my head about that, and I thought, that's about here, and it's about beyond here. I mean, it seemed like a moment when she had passed through a dimension or something when she said that. So I wrote this poem. It kind of exploded out of me obsessively for a while. I was trying to work with it. So anyway, it's called Friend and Beloved. I hope that we will meet again if we meet again. I hope we will meet again. If we meet again, there was so much I didn't say this time. I hope we will meet again if we meet again. Will day break night again when we meet again? I won't be this afraid again when we meet again. Won't that be something? If we meet again, I will play again. When we meet again, if you'll meet again. I won't sleep again if we meet again. I hope we meet again. Shouldn't we meet again if we meet again? What could I say if we met again? The water will be sweet again if we met again. Won't the trees be tall again if we climb again? Would it be here again if we met again? Maybe we could try to meet again. Or is again not like again? I swear we will meet again if we meet again. Don't you think we'll meet again when we meet again? I hope we can meet again. Would you know that we'd met again if we met again? When we meet again, would again seem like again, again. I hope we will meet again, if we meet again. Once we meet again, I hope we will meet again.
Nice.
Oh, it's kind of lunacy, but I don't know. You know, sometimes there are ways that kids think about stuff that clearly represent a connection to a place that adults don't reach easily. I don't think that child had any more thought of what that statement might mean than you know, as if she were brushing a piece of hair out of her eye. But I thought, man, you know, yeah, if we meet again, you know. It just really got me. Anyway, and again, in relation to what I was saying earlier, I'm certainly someone who believes that poetry can serve the human community in general and to serve explicitly different kinds of thinking in terms of political thinking. I think we need, insofar as politics involves changing or imagining new and different ways to be together or be on the planet, I mean, poetry can serve that, but it can, of course, it can serve the interior and the mystical and all the other aspects of connection between people. But I just don't want it to be trapped anywhere. I just think it has to do more and more. I mean, if it's gonna matter, if it's not gonna just sit and collect dust in bookstores or remote rooms in libraries, it has to kind of reach out and say, "Hey, read me." This is important stuff we're trying to get at, really, you know? And so I'm interested in thinking about poetry, I don't know, not aggressively, that's not the term, but in some kind of way that demands an audience in a way. I'm tired of, you know, people romancing the idea that, oh, no one reads poetry. Just a few dedicated souls just read it. I'm like, I'm tired of that. Poetry is important. We got to figure out a way to make it happen. And the spoken word scene is part of that. And the slam scene is connected, of course, to spoken word, but that's part of it. But I mean, beyond that, back to the page, into the books, into the world of contemplation. You know, I really want people to be with language. I mean, that's the seat of human consciousness is language. We can't act like that doesn't matter, you know.
Let me ask you along those lines about breath, because I wanted to ask you about that anyway. In a lot of your poems, you have spaces within the lines. And as you read your poems, breath is really important. I mean, you read slowly and with respect. I'm not sure if it's to each space or line, but to the feel of the work, if nothing else. And you've heard poets who don't read that well.
Right. And, read fast.
Or stilted or stop at the end of each line too long.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you about that idea of spacing, why you're choosing that. You do it a lot in your work as opposed to punctuation or line break. And and if it has to do with what you just said about you want and poetry to have a lot of room in the world and a lot of room to move for the reader to move around the page.
Yeah, it's partly that. Part of it is that I do think of speaking poems, and even as I see them on the page, I think of the way, like, singers phrase their lines. And if you listen to Billie Holiday, or if you listen to my, her name slipped out of my mind. But anyway, any good singer, the line can be the same, but the way they bend it in terms of pause and inflection can add and change meanings in slight ways. And so what I'm hoping to do with white space on the page is allow there to be that sense of, like, there'd be a filling in of other possibilities in the way the line might be heard. I mean, also in speech, we naturally pause. Like, if we're thinking, we're talking about something important, and we'll say, "And I also think," you know, that kind of thing. And I want that to be in the poems as well, because the poems are also a document of a person trying to think through a certain vision or a certain idea about or a certain predicament and trying to work it through in language. And part of that is pausing and measuring which direction you're taking and then taking the next step and maybe pausing again. And sometimes I use a lot of white space because I'm trying to really highlight the idea that each word is like a step into a certain idea or a certain set of ideas. And so I like to do that. And really, the first person I saw do it to really powerful effect was Franz Wright. if you saw some of his early books, The Night World and the Word Night is one. And he has a lot of white space in that mm-hmm. book. And mm-hmm. when I heard him read once, he would have these long silences. And I think it freaked people out. They didn't know what to do with so much silence.
Yeah.
But then bit by bit, it forced you to really pull back and say, oh, and start to step very carefully with him through the poems. And I thought, that's such a powerful thing. By the end of the reading, to me, I thought it was riveting, you know, what he did. And I thought, I'd like to be able to use that. And you can hear it the way silence and space is used also. If you think about saxophone solos or guitar solos, you can hear it too, that oftentimes those hesitations or those moments when the guitar isn't speaking say a lot about what's coming or say a lot about what is past. And so there's a way in which the silence itself is articulate. Now that's, I mean, yeah, that may sound, you know, wildly heady, but yes, it's that.
Okay. I'm hurrying you along because we have time just for a poem or two. No, it sounds great, but I want to hear some more poems.
Lunacy is what it sounds like. All right, well, speaking of white space, let me read this poem. It's called Lobster, if I can find it. It's in the voice, again, of a creature we don't often associate with voice. It's called Lobster for Sale. You'll hear some of the white space, I think, in it. Lobster for sale. Over here in the aquarium, just left of the fresh fillets. Save your sympathy. Usually I'm sleepy, so usually I sleep. And you think I dream of the open sea. Nope. When I sleep, I dream of sleeping. Only difference between this and the big drink. In here, it's just us. And every hour, I measure every side. But sometimes I see you out there eating all that air. The two-legged mouth. You think I'm a grocery, but I don't care what you think. I keep one thought. One. I keep it on like a nightlight all day long. I wish you would reach in here for me. I wish you would.
Poetry of Tim Siebel's, reading from his book Buffalo Head Solos. Thanks so much, Tim. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Jan. It's a pleasure, always.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. All the way down.